The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So I've been thinking quite a bit about technology. To be clear, I'm a geek, but I'm not necessarily an early adopter. I was one of those people that stuck dutifully with my BlackBerry when everyone I knew was going through various forms of salivating lust over the iPhone. I waited for the bugs to be worked out, and then some, before I made the switch, and I ended up being thrilled with it. And when I decided I needed a voice recorder, I looked around and did research on a bunch of different models, but I ended up going with the one that I did primarily because Will Wheaton wrote a post about how happy he was with it. So I'm kind of a geek, but I'm not really a gadget geek. And I find that many of us fall into this category. We do a bit of research, but in the end, we make decisions about what we buy by putting our trust in someone. And tech isn't confined to the things that we purchase. It's the stories about new technology that we read in magazines or on websites. Revolutionary energy sources, medical and health equipment, or on the internet, with a new form of social media popping up practically every day. So what's a skeptic to do? How do we non-experts judge what the next big thing is, and what's too good to be true? John Strickland, Tech Stuff podcaster and senior writer for How Stuff Works, will be on the line later in the show to help us figure it all out. But we'll start off with some speaking up. So we're here today with Tyson Wozniak. By day, he's a bus driver, and in his other life, he's the co-author of the blog skepparent.com that he writes with his wife, Dawn. Thanks for being on Speaking Up, Tyson.
Well, thanks for having me.
So your blog is obviously a parenting skeptically blog.
Yes.
Was this a way for you to share your experiences, or more trying to find other rational parents for playdates with your kids?
probably more of the first option, but maybe a little bit of the second one as well.
So what brought that on?
A lot of it was, like, I've just become a huge fan of a lot of the skeptical media out there, along with a lot of other people. It always seemed like I was all alone. And then finding out that there's a lot more people like me was just great. But I noticed there's not a whole lot of focus on the parenting side of being a skeptic. And it just seemed like there needed to be that. And we had kids and we were skeptics. So we just thought we'd try our hand at it.
And are you enjoying it so far?
I am.
I find that very important, that you actually enjoy what you're doing.
It's one of those, like, things that leading up to it is a lot of hard work, and it's a lot more work than I thought. We had originally planned that we were going to try and get a podcast out every week and write all these articles, and obviously, since we are partially a parenting blog, we have kids as well, and they take up a lot of your time. So it's a lot harder than I was expecting, but it's lots of fun too.
Well, what kinds of things do you write about?
So far, it seems like we've been really heavily steeped in the whole vaccine controversy. I don't really like using the word controversy for that, but it's not a medical controversy. It's more of a PR controversy. But that's where we focused a lot of our attention right now, because it's really in the news, and we have a lot of friends who are anti-vaccine, and it's just something, and we used to be anti-vaccine as well, and so it's something that's kind of close to our hearts. But we don't want our blog to be only that. We do focus a lot on science as well, and how to teach your kids to be scientific and do some experiments and have some fun with science as well.
The blog recently made it to mainstream media, correct?
It did. Phil Plait, the Bad Astronomer, was kind enough to link our post about why we started to vaccinate on his website, and that gave us quite a bit of traffic. It was quite a surprise, and it's been fun watching the comments on that article posting, too.
Well, tell us about the article.
Well, the article is kind of based on our history of, before we had kids, I was always a big fan of science, and I guess I was always sort of a skeptic, but I just didn't really have the tools that I've kind of learned how to do now. But we took our experience of why we didn't want to vaccinate before, what we had heard, what we went through, and our process of learning about all of the vaccine myths and the vaccine sciences, and why we changed our minds and why we decided to vaccinate coming from the background that we did.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. Now, you were actually anti-vaccination, not just that you weren't sure that you were anti. You were one of those.
we were hardcore. Like, I look back on what we were like 4 or 5 years ago, even 3 years ago, and I'm almost ashamed. We were anti-vax. We actually went to see a homeopath once for one of our kids. We were hardcore. We fell hook, line, and sinker into that entire movement.
Right.
And yeah, looking back, it was frightening.
Well, so was it your peer group?
A lot of our peer group, we have a lot of friends who are very naturally minded, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just, it's easy to be led astray, I think, in that my wife's parents are very much into that organic food, lots of vitamins, raw food, vegetarian movement, which that can all be great, but there's a lot of baggage that sometimes comes with that. They're very much into homeopathic stuff and a lot of alternative therapies. So it was easy for us to get into that. And then once I started reading more about, like reading more science blogs and skeptical blogs, and once podcasts came out and I really started listening to those coming to and from work all the time, I started kind of realizing that, well, maybe what we had learned isn't the truth. Maybe it's more of an ideological belief rather than a scientific belief, which caused me to start doing a lot more research and then a lot more conversation with my wife about it. It was probably a rough couple of months, that transition of realizing that we had done something wrong, because when you're so invested into an ideal or an ideologue, that it's hard to pull back out of that. So we fought with that for probably a couple of months between the two of us, and I think we kind of came out of it much, much better skeptics, much better parents, and yeah, it just feels much better.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, and see, that's what I'm wondering about. You said that you did your research.
Right.
But on your blog, I think it was, that you mentioned that you had done research into anti-vaccination before. So what's the difference between what you did before in terms of research and what brought you to being pro-vaccination?
What we did before was, when we first did our research, it was when our first child was just about to be born. And I think a lot of people do a lot of research in that time because everything's so new. You know, everything's going to change. Everything's really exciting. But it's a lot harder to focus down on one topic and do a lot of research into that. So our research basically consisted of Google.
Right.
And whatever was on the front page, so those first 10 posts in Google. And then years later, especially after I started listening to things like The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe and reading Phil Plait's blog and things like that, it kind of made me realize, well, maybe Google's just not the best first area to start looking for research. And I actually started doing a lot more research on the CDC with a bit more of an open mind, where when I was looking on the CDC before, I was looking for, well, what are the side effects? And I wasn't really looking at the odds, the chances of things happening. And one thing I've learned is humans are really, really bad at risk assessment. When you hear, oh my goodness, if I stick this needle in my arm, there's like a 1 in a million chance that I might have a seizure. That's really frightening, because
all you're hearing is the, I'm going to have a seizure.
Right. Oh, yeah. Or I'm going to give my kid a seizure. Like it just comes across as really frightening. And then when you start thinking, well, if we don't vaccinate, we might have a 1 in 10,000 chance of dying of polio or whatever the virus may be. You have to take your emotions out of it, basically, and just look at the facts and look at the statistics. And that's what I did a lot more of the second time. And I also learned a little bit more of critical thought and researching medical journals rather than just online blogs. Like Phil Plait's blog was a good starting place, but just like I had done before with the anti-vax people, I didn't just stop there and take his word for it. I went that next step, and I think that was the big change this time.
So you mentioned in the article that you wrote about your experiences with this, you mentioned the comments.
Mm-hmm.
So from what I read, they were mainly supportive, but some not so much.
Some not so much. They're quite interesting. It's about what I expected. Actually, it's less negative than what I was expecting. I was expecting a lot more hatred and shouting and more caps locks. But surprisingly, there's very little caps locks. But again, it's the same arguments you hear a lot of the time. And again, it's a lot of people who are just either anti-corporate or anti-big pharma, and they're not really looking at the facts and the chances of something happening over another thing.
Right. So is that difficult for you to sort of, to in effect, have to back up your parenting decisions in a public forum?
No, and actually that's kind of the reason why we did this. I've been having a lot of fun talking with people that I know and other skeptics, and just honing my skills as a skeptic as well as honing my skills as a parent. Like, I want to be as good as I can be at both things. Mm-hmm. So part of the reason we started the whole blog and the podcast is to throw our opinions out there and our thoughts after researching it, with the hopes that we're going to get called on some things. Like, I don't expect us to be totally right almost ever. But when we are wrong, we want people to call us on it. So there is actually a comment criticizing The Lancet, because I used that as one of my posts. I said that, like, I was talking about The Lancet, and somebody went on there and said, oh, well, don't you know that they're owned by Big Pharma? And of course, they're all being paid off. And I'm like, well, I don't think so, but let me back up my facts, because I didn't research that. I had never even thought to research that. So I did, and it turns out that that's not true.
Right.
They're totally independent, but it was a good exercise for me. It's like, okay, well, maybe I'm wrong. And that's what I really like about being a skeptic, is I always have that option of being wrong, because I can change my opinion if I am.
Exactly.
And that's my big advantage to doing the blog and the podcast.
So, well, let's talk about the podcast. And,
yes.
And what I wonder is why would you do that to yourself, sir? Because I say this with all the support in the world, but you know, as someone who does this every week, who does not have two small children, that's wow, good on you.
Yeah, it's fun. It like I said, just the same with the blog, probably even more so than the blog, because there's editing involved. It's a lot of work, and it's not as easy as I had thought it was going to be, but it is fun. It's, I mean, just like talking with you, it's just a good chance to have a good conversation, and maybe one or two people out there might find it interesting as well, so why not? And if we can kind of help somebody figure out what we did as parents and not go 2 years without vaccinating your kids, or just kind of help somebody out and not even change their opinion, just give them another idea, I think that's great.
Well, I think the podcast is great. Especially one of the segments that you use is a news segment, but it's mm-hmm. news that you can talk about with your children.
Which mostly, is, yeah.
It's a fantastic idea. In the first episode, you spoke about the recent LCROSS bombing the moon mission.
Yes,
and you spoke about it in the simplest terms possible. and that's perfect. You could relate the facts and the reasons and the results of the mission in the way that you presented it.
Yeah.
So, what else do you plan to cover?
I'm a science news junkie. So I'm constantly reading about anything that pops up, whether it's on another science blog or a skeptics blog or Wired. And I'm a gadget junkie as well, to the point that frustrates my wife. We probably spend a little bit more on gadgets than we should. But anything that me or her finds interesting, I just want to chat about there. And if it's something that can promote science and science education, all the best. Because there's so much, whether it's LCROSS or the LHC, there's so much cool technology that's coming up. And it's going to change our kids' lives. I mean, I think back between when I was 5 years old and now, and what's changed. I mean, cell phones and the internet. And I realized the other day that my son is not going to grow up knowing what commercials are on TV. That's the world. Yeah, that's yeah. And it's such a simple topic, but that's the world that we live in now. So there's so much changing, and things like solar technology, nuclear energy, being improved the way it is now. Like, it's not like it was when we grew up. So all those kinds of things, I think, are important to expose to kids. And that's what we want to talk about in those news segments, is sometimes just a fun kind of cheesy story, but for the most part, it's stuff that's going to lead into something else, or maybe get somebody, whether it's a parent or a child, interested in science. And that's where our news section focuses on.
Well, how would you explain something like the Large Hadron Collider to a 4-year-old?
Well, I was talking about it a little bit with my 4-year-old. Pictures help, because it's hard for kids to think of things like that. Like, it's hard for me to understand just how massive this thing is. This giant tube full of magnets and gases and wires, and like, it is absolutely massive. So pictures help. There's maps there that show where it is underneath the ground. There's maps of it actually underneath the ground, so you can see somebody standing. They're so small compared to how big this giant magnetic tube is. And so showing that to get the science across and the reality across, and then just talking about how you have these little tiny particles that you're throwing as fast as you can, trying to get them up as fast as the speed of light, and just smashing together, and there's going to be hopefully this huge explosion. And part of it is over exaggerating a little bit, maybe overselling it, mm-hmm. just to get their excitement going, because I don't expect him to understand physics at age 4. But by getting him excited in something like the Large Hadron Collider, it's something that will grow with him.
Well, the other way that you do that is, and also on the podcast, you discuss the weekly science project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, we have lots of fun with that.
Tell us about it.
That's just something that we were doing even before the podcast. It's just going online, or we have a book that's full of science experiments. Actually, we have a couple books full of science experiments, and just opening up to a random page, or finding a random website, or even thinking of something on your own, and just doing science, and not even selling it as science. Like, we always just call it, oh, let's go do an experiment now. So we do an experiment and just have fun with something. We did one where we were learning about gravity, where you just stick a piece of paper in a cookie sheet and get some marbles and cover them in paint. You throw the marble on the piece of paper and you move the cookie sheet around, and you're painting something, but at the same time you're learning how gravity works. If you tilt the pan one way, the marble rolls down and leaves a trail of paint. So, I mean, that's art and science mixed together. It's great. Another one was tying a string on the back of two chairs and tying a balloon on a straw around the string and blowing up the balloon, letting the balloon go, and watching the balloon fly over to the other chair. And the longer the string is, the more your little balloon rocket's going to go, and the more fun it's going to be. And like, we spent, probably an hour doing that. And that's just learning basics of propulsion and rockets. And it's not hammering the science home, but doing these little experiments and having fun with them. I think that's the key part.
You actually have him document his findings as well.
Yeah, he got a little journal. We went, because we are here in Vancouver, we go to Science World all the time. That's one of his favorite places. And we got a little Sid the Science Kid journal. So we use the journal, and he writes things. Well, I usually do most of the writing, but he tells me what to write down. We make little observations, and yeah. We try to do good 4-year-old science.
And that's the key, because I'm assuming he doesn't necessarily realize that he's receiving a science education. This is just something fun he does with Dad every week.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think what some people try and do is they really try and push, okay, well, this is called this, and I use science terms. We did another one where we were talking about solutions, and you need to use the science terms. You need to be literate yourself using, like saying dilutions instead of whatever else you want to say, using the term mixture because it actually is a scientific definition of something. Using those in the proper context without pushing it on the kids. I think that's the big part. And they'll just pick it up. I mean, with anything, kids are sponges. They're educational sponges. and you'll be amazed at what they can learn. And even when you think that they're not learning something, they are. My biggest surprise was my son's favorite album right now is They Might Be Giants, Here Comes Science. And we were coming home one day, we were just taking off our shoes, and I had mentioned a shooting star. And I hadn't talked to him about this at all, but they have a song about a shooting star. And he looks up at me and he tells me, "Daddy, a shooting star is not a star." And I'm like, "Oh, what is it?" He goes, "It's a meteorite." And I was just like, "Oh, wow."
I love my son.
Yeah. It was like, wow, this kid, he's learning even when I'm not teaching.
Well done, sir.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
These are all great projects, Tyson. I very much highly encourage people to go check out your site, to read and hear more from you and from Dawn as well.
Oh, thank you.
So, everybody who wants to, please do. It's skepparent.com, and it does not have two P's.
Right. One P.
Parent.
Yeah.
And they can also follow you on Twitter.
Yes. Yeah, it's just at skepparent. And I try and tweet as much as I can, but like I said before, we have two kids.
I admire that you're doing any of this at all. A lot of people are just sitting watching sitcoms at this point.
That's true.
Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, either through the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still hear the broadcast live on our ustream.tv feed, which you can find by clicking the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to those stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LPFM 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia, CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia, CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio, 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario, CLHI, Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia, Freethought Radio, and WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Before we get to the interview, I have one announcement that I just recently got. The Greater Edmonton Skeptic Society is having their first annual general meeting. That's Tuesday, March 16th, and if you would like more info, do visit edmontonskeptics.org. So today we're on the line with John Strickland. John is a senior writer for the computer and electronics channels of HowStuffWorks.com. He's also the co-host for the Tech Stuff podcast, as well as a contributor to How Stuff Works blogs. While most of his work is about technology, Jonathan writes articles on everything from the Necronomicon to National Yo-Yo Day. Thanks for being here, John.
Thanks for having me. I'm really thrilled to be here.
Lovely. So let's set the stage a bit. You came into some skeptical attention recently when TechStuff did an episode on ghost hunting equipment.
That's correct. Yes, we get a lot of suggestions from our listeners, and one of our listeners specifically asked us to tackle ghost hunting technology, and I immediately leapt at the opportunity. I hadn't really considered tackling that subject, but once I had the excuse, I was more than happy to bully my co-host into doing it.
So how did the episode go?
The episode, I think, went rather well from my perspective. I did end up calling it later my 27-and-a-half-minute long rant. But once I get going on a subject, it is kind of hard to calm me down. So I was very pleased with it, and I was overwhelmed by the response we received. I was a little worried when we talked about it because, you know, you never really know what your listeners are going to react to. And Tech Stuff is not presented as a skeptically oriented show. Mm-hmm. So I was a little concerned to see what the response would be. I didn't know. You know, I was monitoring my Twitter followers to see if I was going to suddenly have a massive drop off or if I'd start getting hate mail. But fortunately, the overwhelming response so far has been very positive.
So, has there been any negative?
Oh, sure. We've received one or two messages.
So, do you self-identify as a skeptic then? Or do you consider skepticism a natural extension of analyzing technology?
I don't think it's natural. I think a lot of... I know a lot of people who do technology news. They report on it or they blog about it. And some of them have kind of that natural skeptical bent. And some of that comes from being a reporter as well. Some reporters are really good about developing that. Others, not so much. But there are some who will see a press release and immediately report it as being fact without spending a little more time thinking about what the implications are.
Okay, so ghost hunting isn't really the only area of the paranormal that may misuse technology, as you covered in your show. Now, before the show, I sent you a link to a website that sells a device that
yes.
claims to enable you to test your psychic ability.
Yeah, I read about this. It's pretty fascinating stuff. I bet it's really, really good at flashing a question mark and then letting you push a button. Beyond that, I'm not so sure. Here's the thing about the link you sent me, the PsyQ Psychic Tester.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is that it prompts you to think about a shape, and I think it's supposed to be solid or hollow. And if you think it's one, you press one button. If you think it's going to be the other, you press the other button. Then it reveals to you the shape, and if you hit a certain number, then supposedly you're psychic because you've managed to do better than chance. I have many problems with this.
Do tell.
Problem number one is, you don't know how they programmed it, because maybe they programmed it so that on 85% of the time when you press a button, it's going to show you that picture no matter what. So there's no random chance there in that case. It would be easy enough to do. In fact, if you really wanted to, you could have it where whichever button they press, show that picture. And then you suddenly think, wow, I'm the most psychic person who ever existed. That's just one issue. But another issue is that perhaps the random number generator, whichever one, if it's a coin flip type situation, maybe it's not working properly. Maybe it naturally does one more than the other. And so it's a meaningless piece of equipment.
So how do you judge that? Like, do you use the same method to judge something like a psi tester that you do to judge ghost hunting equipment?
Well, I really just rely on our old friend, the scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the claim and I think, well, for this claim to be true, what would need to be there? Like, what kind of things would need to fall into place? And some of that's fairly simple. You would say, all right, well, let's test the equipment as it is. I'm not an electrician, so I'm not going to be able to take it apart and see how it was put together and how it was programmed. But I might be able to put it through a test. And if someone is truly psychic, whatever that may mean, and if someone is able to predict accurately what this is, you know, what shape is going to be shown, they should be able to do it at any time, any number of times,
right.
Should be completely repeatable. And if I were seeing a lot of 100% responses or 99.99% responses, then I would say, you know what, we need to bring this to someone who can actually take it apart, take a look, and see if the random generator is truly random.
Okay, so you mentioned the scientific method. So,
yes.
And that's suitable for use with any technology, correct?
Yes. You want to be able to really think things through and break it down into their component parts. And in some cases, it doesn't even get you to the point of looking at the technology. You just have to look at the claim. If the claim itself doesn't make sense, then it doesn't matter what the technology does. If you turn on a switch or you plug it in, if the claim doesn't make sense, the technology's just magic.
Okay, so how about Acclaim? I sent you another link to a post on Skeptic North, the Canadian skeptical blog. Now, one of them was about Kangen water.
Okay, so this is a good example of what I was just talking about. Kangen water is supposed to create an ionized water, maybe an alkaline water. First of all, that's ionized water is meaningless. If you're using pure water, there are very few ions in water. It doesn't matter if you run an electric charge through the water. You're not going to get a lot of electrolysis there. That's what we call when you put apply an electric charge to something in order to release ions. This is often used to do things like to harvest hydrogen. The big argument about hydrogen fuel cells is that it's pretty hard to get hold of hydrogen, and in order to separate hydrogen from water to get the hydroxide and the hydrogen, you have to pour a lot of energy into it. So it's a net loss of energy. Well, pure water doesn't ionize well at all. And if the other argument of Kangen water is that it makes an alkaline water, which supposedly is better absorbed through your body, your body does that. Actually, when you drink water and it goes through your stomach and into your lower intestine, your pancreas kind of creates an alkaline solution already. So you don't need an alkaline water. So immediately the claim itself doesn't hold any, well, water, I guess, but the device itself, therefore, it doesn't matter if it buzzes or whirls or if lights come on or off. It's not doing anything.
So how is the average person, though, without any technical or medical background, supposed to determine whether that's a technology that has merit or if it's a scam?
That's an excellent question, and here's my answer. I am an English major. My major was in English literature with a focus on Shakespearean tragedies. So with that in mind, with my extensive scientific background, it's amazing that I could come to these conclusions. Fortunately for me, there is this wonderful thing called the internet. So a little research goes a long way, and really it's paying attention to the quality of the research. Once you're aware of certain things, like what is a peer-reviewed journal, what are the reputable sources of information? What would be considered a faulty source of information? And you really start to think about that. Then you can build on those resources and start to come to informed decisions and informed points of view.
If you out there have a question for John about investigating technology, you can reach us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or by Twitter at Skeptical Radio. Okay, so, John, part of the problem here is that there's an emotional aspect to alternative health equipment specifically. So do you think it's harder to think rationally about things that are related to your health?
It's definitely a challenge, especially if either you or someone you love is suffering from some sort of malady. There's just a natural inclination to feel empathy or sympathy toward that person, to want to help them. And I think the average person, and I'll even include myself in this, you want to believe there is something you can do, and you don't want to feel helpless. You don't want the other person to feel helpless either. And it does become a challenge to separate that emotional need with a rational approach to what you should be doing. But I think that's the most important time for you to really think rationally about things. Don't just set your emotions aside, because clearly, I mean, we are emotional creatures and we shouldn't deny that, but don't let them guide your decisions.
Okay, now the claims of some types of technology, like, for example, the Psi tester and Kangen water to a certain extent, are fairly easy to be skeptical of. Mm-hmm. But there's tons of technology out there where it's not so clear. So how do we judge the new technologies, like the ones that we read about in the paper or we see on the news?
So can we talk about Bloombox for a second?
It's like you're reading my mind, sir.
All right. So Bloombox, that's here's an example, I think, of misreporting or misrepresentation of what claims were that kind of blew out of control. Bloombox, if you listen to certain reports, it sounded like it was this magical device that would just produce energy ad infinitum, and our energy crisis would be no more, and we would all be happy and singing songs and drinking Coca-Cola. As it turns out, Bloombucks is really just a new version of a fuel cell technology, which is not, it's a power generator, but it's not like energy's coming from nowhere. It's a fuel cell. So you have fuel. You're using fuel to generate energy. Once you get away from the free energy misinterpretation, and I think that was mostly just a misstep by the media. From what I can see of the Bloombucks website, there's no claim there whatsoever of any kind of free energy approach. Once you get past that, you see, okay, well, this makes sense. It's another way of generating power. It's not magical. There's nothing mystical about it. It's not a free energy source. These are challenges that we face where the reporting itself is faulty. I think if it just sounds like it's the old adage, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And it just warrants that extra step. And in my view, one thing you need to do is just go to the source before making any other judgments. When you hear about some sort of really cool technology, go to the website of that company and look into it and see if the claims on the company's webpage match what you heard in the news. If they do, then the next step is to say, all right, well, how likely are these claims? Do they sound rational? Do they sound like they're realistic? A lot of companies will make claims that are beyond the ability of their technology.
But is the media underestimating the public? Like, does it think it has to use small words with us because otherwise we won't understand?
I'm not sure. It's so tough to use a broad generalization like that, because the media, saying the media makes it sound like I'll include myself in that, makes it sound like we're this one big mass and we all have groupthink going on and we all know exactly the right way, or we think we know the right way to reach an audience. I think it comes down to the style of individual reporters. I think some reporters are so under the gun to meet deadlines, and they themselves have, some of them, very limited scientific backgrounds. So they don't really question so much. If they hear a remarkable claim, they may just go ahead and report it as opposed to look into it further. And in some ways, I can even understand that happening, because when you look around you at the technology that we have at our disposal, some of that technology is mind-blowing.
Exactly.
I mean, I look at my smartphone, for example, which has a touch screen and has an operating system and applications. And as I'm scrolling through on a touch screen, I'm thinking, oh my God, how did I get into the future? I mean, I'm able to play video games on this thing. I'm able to surf the web. I have at my disposal, in my hand, portable, wherever I go, the ability to tap into the World Wide Web and do research on any topic I can imagine. Right there. That, to me, is phenomenal. And when you live in a world like that where the phenomenal becomes normal, it gets a lot easier to accept claims that sound bizarre.
And especially when we're talking about energy technologies, that area, it seems like the research and development is moving amazingly quickly. So it's understandable that people, you know, would be confused about what qualifies as a breakthrough.
Sure. And with energy, we have a whole level of other complicating factors that come in. I mean, it's not just the fact that the energy technology is developing so quickly, but we have a lot of different pressures acting on us. We have pressures about just running low on resources, or at least feeling like we're running low on resources. We've got the pressure of clean technology and green tech. Everyone wants to be seen as a green technology leader, even if they have nothing to do with green tech whatsoever. They want to be able to jump on that and get that good PR. So, I mean, the topic of technology is just getting more and more complex. Not only is the technology itself getting more complex, but it's getting more political, and with all these other elements coming in, it's just, you know, it's a real challenge to navigate through it.
We have a question from the chat room.
All right.
It is from B.A. Drescher. She asks, have you looked into CO2 and radon gas detectors and so forth?
You know, we haven't looked at that. That would be a good topic for a future podcast. The things that we were looking at specifically for Ghost Hunter technology were things like EMF detectors, which they have a hard, I mean, they've got a bad name in the skeptical community. They actually do serve a very good purpose. It's just, it's not the purpose that the ghost hunters are using it for.
Right.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that one specifically, although I will now add it to my list, which I'm always doing because that's very helpful. So yeah, I can't really talk about it because I haven't really done the research on it, but that would be an interesting one to touch on.
Audience, if you have questions like that one, or about the difference between a technological breakthrough and a piece of clever marketing, you can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be back with more of John Strickland on investigating technology right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, author Sharon Bertsich-McGraney joins us to discuss the lives, careers, and Nobel Prize-winning research of women scientists. And on Speaking Up, Heidi Anderson previews SheThought.com, a new website celebrating the contributions of women to science and critical thinking. Women in the Sciences, next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live on CJSR and at SkepticallySpeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with Jonathan Strickland, Tech Stuff host and senior writer for How Stuff Works.
You must have seen my father in the chat room.
Your father's in the chat room?
He is. Because he talked about, usually I just have people call me Jonathan, not John.
Oh, even if people don't have long versions of their name initially, I tend to lengthen them. I'm not a nickname person. And actually, since your father's there, somebody sent in the question, are you related to Brad Strickland, the science fiction writer?
I am. Brad Strickland, the science fiction writer, is in fact my father.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually grew up in a house that was very well versed in science and science fiction. We would have other science fiction and fantasy authors over to the house all the time. My father corresponded with some people that you may have heard of, like Isaac Asimov. That's a name that some people know. Ray Bradbury, things like that.
Oh my.
So yeah, growing up in that house was it's one of those things where as a kid you don't realize how amazing it is, but as an adult you think, wow, what an incredible childhood.
Well, now that you've made us all jealous, so a great deal of the difficulty surrounding investigating technology is hype. So let's sort through some of that, and I'm totally going to show my age. VHS versus Beta.
Oh.
Now, ooh. I can tell you, my family chose badly, very badly, with the help of a fine Radio Shack employee who said that VHS would never go anywhere. How were we to know that?
We weren't. This was one of those, I'll tell you a kind of a parallel. I backed HD DVD. I didn't purchase an HD DVD player, but I was absolutely certain at the beginning of the HD DVD versus Blu-ray battle that HD DVD would come out on top because it had more movie studios behind it, it was cheaper, and it got to the market first, and none of that mattered ultimately. Now, with the same with VHS and Beta, now back then, yeah, the Beta actually provided a slightly better picture, but VHS's advantages were pretty huge. I mean, the fact that you could record on a VHS cassette as opposed to the old Beta ones, they didn't have that capability when Beta came out. That, I think, was the death knell for Beta, really. It was just that VHS was slightly more flexible. That's an interesting question, because we actually have talked about that battle before. We like to talk about when two different technologies go head-to-head and what kind of factors seem to go into one coming out on top versus another. And it's not always quality.
Well, actually, there's a related question from the website.
What is your opinion on why the iPod genre beat the Walkman genre and effectively all others so badly in the mobile music realm?
Oh, that is an excellent question. So here's what I think about that. The iPod is an incredibly well-designed device. It is simple to understand. It is very sleek and sexy in a way that a lot of other devices weren't. Other devices were very utilitarian, and they worked great. In fact, you could argue that in the world of MP3 players, the iPod was not near the top of the high performers. But because the iPod's form factor was so eye-catching, and because Apple is amazing at marketing, it really got a jump on everyone else. And now iPod has become a name kind of like Kleenex or Xerox. When you talk about an MP3 player, chances are you're going to say iPod, not MP3 player, whether you're using an iPod or not. I mean, we call it podcasting.
Right.
It's, you know, the marketing machine of Apple is phenomenal. Whether or not they can leverage that to actually make the iPad a success, that remains to be seen.
Well, where are you on the iPad then?
I'm on the iPad. I did not pre-order mine today, so that should say something.
Okay.
No, I think the iPad does have an audience. I just don't think that I fit into that audience. And I'm skeptical, to use a popular word on this show, that the iPad will be that useful to that many people. I think some people will get the iPad, they'll love it, they'll use it for about 3 months, and then eventually as that 3 months has gone on, they'll use it less and less, until one day they just see it laying around, they're like, oh yeah, that thing. It's just awkward enough to not be incredibly useful. It's too hard to input information into the iPad form factor, so you're not going to use it for anything like instant messaging or going onto a message board and typing up something there, or going to a blog post, unless you get the little keyboard accessory that you can plug
right.
it into. But otherwise, it's too hard to type into it. You can use it as a media viewer, but in that case, it's really just a larger iPod Touch. Although some of the apps that are being developed specifically for the iPad, so maybe the killer app will come out that will make the iPad truly a must-have device. Now, I've said that if they can make it interoperable with the Macintosh so that you're looking at one thing on the Mac and you can take notes on your iPad and it automatically syncs the two, now that would be really useful for me, because I would be researching something on the computer, writing it down on an electronic pad, automatically have it sync so that all my research and notes are together in a very easily accessible way. I would just abandon paper then. But right now, that's not happening.
Okay, now you're talking about, you know, specific features and functionality. And so that makes sense. That's tangible. But how do people judge something like digital cameras? Like, is a whatever megapixel camera automatically better than a whatever megapixel camera?
So,
like, is
so
there
yeah.
a real difference?
The megapixels make it easy for people who sell cameras to sell cameras. Megapixels do matter to an extent. Megapixels, that's telling you how many pixels are being crammed into that photo you're looking at. If you're using a camera with a low megapixel count, let's say it takes photos with 3 megapixel level, often that camera will take pictures that are as good, if not better, than a 5 megapixel camera, because ultimately the quality of the image doesn't depend so much on how many pixels are in there as it does on things like the lens quality, the quality of the flash, and the settings that the camera has. If you can set it to very specific parameters so that it's good in any kind of situation, like if you're outside and you need to set it to a certain level. Megapixels only really come into play if you're planning on printing or displaying really large images. So let's say you take a photo of a high school class and you want to blow it up to a poster size. Well, then you're going to want a camera with a high megapixel count so that when you do blow it up, you don't lose resolution. But at the normal size of photos, like 5x7 or even 8x10, the difference between, say, a 5 megapixel and a 12 megapixel camera that's really not what you should be looking at. You should be looking at things like, is the lens a good lens? You know, test these cameras.
I understand that, but I also know that internet forums are full of people that would swear on their mothers that those megapixels would make all the difference. And these are often people who work in the industry, people who are supposed to know what they're talking about. So sometimes does it come down to the expert's personal preference?
It could come down to expert personal preference. It also could come down to how those experts are using their digital cameras. If those experts are doing a lot of posters, then a high megapixel count's going to matter. Especially, I mean, if you look at professional cameras, digital cameras, you're talking well in excess of 15 megapixels, which we don't see on the consumer market, really. On the consumer market, 12 is around where you top out, but you'll get far more than 15 megapixels for some of the more advanced cameras. And in cases where you're going to coat the side of a building with an image, that's going to be important. I think that it does come down to personal preference. It may be that the cameras they use happen to have other qualities that make it a better camera, and it just so happens that one of those qualities is also more megapixels, but that doesn't necessarily mean that megapixel equals quality. It's just that the two happen to be going together in this one camera. I've had cameras where I've had a 10 megapixel camera that took decent photos, but then I had this little 3.1 megapixel camera that in my mind should not take nearly as nice an image, and yet the image consistently is of a higher quality.
Okay, so back to the non-expert. How can people think critically about things that are, in effect, subjective, or at least somewhat subjective?
Yeah, this is a real tricky question. This also leads into the whole discussion about things like cables. Cables are a really good example. Audio cables, video cables, that kind of thing. There's a real push in electronic stores, especially ones where you're going to be paid on commission, to sell high-end audio or video cables, with the argument being that the more expensive cables are going to provide a much better experience. And some people may feel that they are having a legitimately better experience. The placebo effect is not limited to medication. You can have a placebo effect if you're told you're going to get a better picture when you use this particular cable, you may very well believe it when you see it, even if you were to use very expensive equipment to measure the images and find that there's no real measurable difference. Or even there might be a measurable difference, but it's not a perceptible one. It's a tricky situation. I think once you get it in your mind that this must be better than that, it takes a lot to convince you otherwise. The only thing I can say is do your research. There are a lot of websites out there that do very good product reviews that break down whether or not the claims that any company make are hold any merit. We don't do product reviews at HowStuffWorks.com, but we do discuss things like, is there really a difference between a $10,000 audio cable and the $25 audio cable?
Audience, if you'd like to rail against the unfairness of it all, live at skepticallyspeaking.com or by Twitter at Skeptical Radio. We do have one question from the website.
I heard that commercial jetpacks are finally becoming available at a cost of $86,000 and a year-long wait. Given that the price will come down at some point, do you see personal flight coming close to the ubiquity of personal automobiles?
I don't think that's a real word.
Ubiquity? I'm going to be using that in an article tomorrow, and then my editor will knock it off on Monday. Two things. One, the $86,000 jetpack is not a jetpack. It uses propellers, so by definition, it's not a jetpack. Because a jetpack would have to use air and turbines and things of that nature, and this thing does not use that. However, it does let you frickin' fly in the air. So I'll drop the little technical issue there.
All right.
I don't think that the price is ever going to fall down to the level where it's going to be within the average person's means to purchase one of these things as anything other than a curiosity. It's not going to – I mean, the things are enormous. They're not – practical. They're not easy to get in and out of. And also, ultimately, governments, I believe, and I hope at any rate, would legislate the heck out of these things, because I don't know about you. I don't know what the traffic's like up there. In Atlanta, if there's a piece of cardboard on the road, that's going to cause a traffic snarl that goes back dozens of miles. I can't imagine the kind of traffic incidents you would have with people zipping around like Superman all over the city.
I'm not sure if that would happen here. This is, we don't even have mountains, sir. This is prairie country.
Oh, well, then you're fine.
Okay, great.
I will
accept my jetpack now.
Yeah, we've got really tall buildings, and all I can imagine is watching someone scrape the third person off my window that morning. It's just, I don't want to deal with that.
Nicely put, sir.
Thank you.
We'll take one last question from the website.
Will Twitter eventually go through the same privacy issues as Facebook? Should I get out now while I still can?
Ooh, good question. Well, you know, Twitter just added the location-based app where you can choose to activate it, and it will tell people essentially where you are when you send a Twitter message. It does not work in all browsers. It doesn't work on all phones yet, but they're slowly improving it, which means that as you're out on the town and you send out a Twitter message, not only will people see when you sent that message, they'll see where you are. That can cause a legitimate concern about your privacy. We've already seen websites like pleaserobme.com post, yeah, like so-and-so's out of their house. It's a perfect time to go and rob them blind. There are some concerns to have, but so far Twitter's been pretty good about giving the power to the user to choose whether or not to enable it. If you're concerned about your privacy, I suggest you do not enable it. The thing that I think Twitter's really going to run into, and it's going to have to run into it really soon, is not about privacy, but about funding. Twitter still does not have a revenue-generating model yet. It's existing solely on venture capital, which means people are investing money in it in the hopes that eventually Twitter will become so amazingly profitable they will recapture all their costs plus profit. But if that doesn't happen, what we'll see with Twitter is essentially a small micro version of the dot-com bubble burst back in 2000, where people poured money, tons and tons of money, into the dot-com industry far beyond its actual value. And when everyone suddenly realized that there was more money going in than could ever possibly come out of these ventures, everyone tried to get out, and then there was just this massive crash. I see the same thing happening with Twitter if they do not find a way of generating money on a pretty massive scale. The last time I heard about the valuation of the company, it was an insane $1 billion. This for a company that wasn't earning money
yet. Interesting. So where do you think it's going then?
What, Twitter? Mm-hmm. I hope it's not going anywhere because I love it.
I'm in, yes.
But yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly useful tool for me. I love the fact that it lets me be in touch with my listeners, plus my friends and peers and colleagues within the industry. It's an incredibly useful tool. I think because it's an incredibly useful tool, that's why people have been willing to invest money into it, because everyone recognizes that Twitter has a legitimate use, but no one's figured out how they're going to monetize that and keep it going. There's some really, really super smart people over at Twitter, and there are a lot of super smart people who are investing in it. I know there are discussions going on about how to really turn Twitter into a profitable company. I just don't know if they've settled on what they're going to do. My hope is that sometime this year we'll finally see a real promising revenue generating strategy from Twitter.
Speaking of Twitter, I do have to give a shout out to Patrick Neville, who actually introduced you and I over Twitter.
Yes.
So
Patrick Neville, he's great. He's sent me lots of really helpful tweets. So Patrick's awesome.
Thanks, Patrick. And that is for us. We are out of time. Thanks so much for being here, John.
Thank you. And remember, guys, howstuffworks.com.
I was totally going to plug
cool
it, too.
Articles on there.
And I'll say it again. John Strickland, howstuffworks.com. And you can find us, our website, at skepticallyspeaking.com. Do click the links that will take you to our Twitter feed, our Facebook page, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to this show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online. Reading tarot cards and witches, psychics. And their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams. The charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus. Eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope telescope magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies, bring it on. The skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.